Support for our podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Advanced genomic testing may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if you could look into a crystal ball and figure out you're going to have the flu this year? We have to deal with a running nose and 100-plus degree fever, dragging yourself around like an extra on Walking Dead until the influenza finally leaves the frail and weakened host known as your body. Well, aside from knocking people out of a couple of days of work, the flu can have a much more serious impact, contributing to tens of thousands of deaths, hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations each year in the U.S. So the ability to predict when and where the flu might strike or how bad it is going to be would allow public health professionals, doctors and nurses, and you, to prepare for the flu season. And scientists are hard at work on refining and improving how we can forecast the flu. Joining me now are two scientists working on tracking how the virus spreads. Rumi Chunara is an assistant professor at the College of Global Public Health and the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at New York University. Jeffrey Shaman is associate professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University's famous Mailman School of Public Health. They're with me in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Rumi,
how good are we at forecasting the flu? Because last year we were not very good.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the flu happens every year, but we still don't have a good idea of factors like who's going to be affected first, where that'll happen, and then, of course, when exactly that peak week might be. These are all still open questions.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, does using data like Google search queries help predict the flu?
Absolutely. I should note that they've actually switched it off at this point, Google has, but online search query activity, social media, these can be used to create, using statistical algorithms, to create proxies that estimate how much flu there is going around. And we can take, and we will take, any kind of surveillance data that we can get our hands on, because it's incomplete. It's not as good as it needs to be in order for us to really make good forecasts.
Do you think that these new wearable products people are using, with watches and Fitbits and things, might help someday?
Absolutely. You know, you can imagine a day, some point in the future, maybe it's 20, 30 years away, where you just cough into your phone or your watch, and it tells you what you have, and then that's loaded up to the cloud, and public health officials have access to the type of diseases and pathogens that are propagating around in a population.
Now, I understand your team was the winner of last year's, and you tied for first place this year in the CDC's Predict the Influenza Season Challenge. Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
How come you were so good at that?
Well, what we try to do when we do our predictions is we try to emulate what they do in numerical weather prediction. And then to make predictions there, we use three ingredients, just as they do in weather. So the first ingredient you need is a dynamical model that describes the system. For weather, it's a model that describes the dynamics and thermodynamics of the atmosphere. For flu, we use one that describes the propagation of the pathogen through a local population. The second ingredient you need are observations. And the better they are, the better you're going to do with your forecasts. Mm-hmm. Obviously, for weather, they use satellites, ground-based stations, balloons, etc. We use estimates of influenza incidence, be it from the CDC, hospital networks, syndromic surveillance, Google flu trends. The last ingredient are statistical methods that we use to combine the two. And the idea is to try to optimize the model before you make the forecast. Because if you make a model, use the model just to make a forecast without informing it of what's been going on in the local populations, it does a really bad job.
Mm-hmm. So, Rumi, now you've brought along, because you now have a sort of a do-it-yourself go viral study. And it actually takes samples from people that you're going to help me take a sample today?
Yeah, let's
describe what's going on.
Yeah, so basically, as part of our kit, which anyone can sign up for on the website, we have two collection methods. One is for saliva collection and one is a nasal swab. And so the idea is whoever is sick, when they get sick, they can follow our instructions and, you know, in a couple minutes, generate these specimens and send them to us, and we can actually figure out what was causing the illness.
I have the saliva one here. You can hear I'm already collecting saliva.
Yeah.
You want me to fill that up?
Yeah.
Okay, that's as much as I can get out of that. Then I fold the top and I seal it.
Yep.
And I put it in a box that's going to send it back to you.
Exactly.
And then I have this nasal swab kit. How does that work?
Yep. So in this case, we're getting a sample from within the nose, and it's not like the nasopharyngeal swab that you might get at a doctor. That's a little bit very invasive. But this one just goes right into the base of your nose.
You stick it up my nose?
Yeah,
people
centimeter
who are asking
or two
me to
in.
Do that for years. Just right. Up my nose,
yep,
whatever.
Rotating it around.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Here you go. Okay. And then what do I do?
And
there's
then,
a little test tube here. Like.
Exactly. A little viral transfer
top.
Medium.
Okay.
Pop that in.
Stick that in.
Mm-hmm.
And then what? Break it off?
Exactly.
Let's see if I can do that.
Yep. Just
come on.
Up
oh,
higher
there it goes.
A little bit.
There's a little thing. Yeah. I'm good at doing it. Oh, there it is. Oh, almost got it.
Yeah.
All right. What the heck? It's in there. And then you would seal that up and send it back to you.
Exactly. So we send it to a lab where we get a gold standard detection test done. So we use PCR. And from a panel of common respiratory viruses, influenza and other ones like coronaviruses or other commonly circulating viruses, we test and see what was in both of the specimens.
So can you tell where then around the country the flu is spreading from getting the test kit back?
Yeah, exactly. So just like Jeff mentioned, there's a lot of data sources we can now get at scale coming from sources like Google Flu Trends, et cetera. So our data source, we're hoping to add to that with a little bit more specificity. Of course, the number of specimens that get processed is going to be smaller than number of people searching on Google, but we're trying to, you know, combine these two data sources and be able to, in a more specific way, exactly look at where flu is around the country and when it's happening.
So is it possible for you two to sort of combine your data to get a better forecast of what's happening?
I think that would be ideal with our data and, you know, Jeff's worked tremendously in this space about the methods. That would kind of be the next step.
We're always searching for new observations because the way we surveillance infectious diseases is very passive. And we can have an active surveillance system where we're going out and seeing what people have and bring that data to bear, it's going to improve our forecast models.
Is there a forecast already for this year's flu season?
It's a little early. So the type of forecasts that we do really are based on activity already being present in a local population. We can't predict in April what's going to happen next year. And so, for instance, a type of prediction where you'd want to know what kind of strains do you want to, or antigens do you want to put in a vaccine? That's not the type of prediction that we can do. That's a much more difficult problem. But once the outbreak begins to go in a local population, we can see how it's going to grow, what the timing of it's going to be, and how it'll spread.
So how accurate?
Well, you know, accuracy is all relative, and I'm not trying to dodge the question.
Well, I know you won a contest.
Well, we won a contest. Good. Well, you know, I can give you an example. Yeah. For instance, the first year that we did this at scale for the whole United States for about 100 cities, about 63% of the cities at the end of December, we were accurately predicting when the peak was going to be in advance of when they occurred. And it rose up to about 70%.
Pretty good.
Now, but it's like the weather, you know. The forecast for rain tomorrow is much better than the forecast of rain 3 weeks later. And one of the other things that we want to do with this is we don't want to just say flu is going to peak in New York City or in Seattle in 5 weeks. We want to give a certainty to it. We want to say there's an 80% chance or a 20% chance. And we can actually infer these from the models. That's something called the calibration, the same way they do it in weather prediction. And by having that kind of certainty in the information that calibrates it probabilistically, it's much more informative. You're much more likely to do something if you hear there's an 80% chance the flu is going to peak in 3 weeks as a public health official than if you hear there's a 20% chance the flu will peak in 3 weeks.
So you're predicting that the odds of the flu breaking out in a certain place, like the weather forecast. Rumi, we know the flu is going to happen every single year. Mm-hmm. Why is it so hard to predict where it's going to have an impact? I mean, what the flu, you know, why was it so hard to make a flu virus a vaccine that didn't work last year and you can make it better maybe this year?
I guess there's a variety of reasons. It's complex. One of the issues that we're hoping to address is that the data that we get right now coming from Sentinel sites, the CDC doctor's offices and hospitals, often rely on people who have more than just a mild illness. They're sick enough to come into the doctor's office. But at the same time, there's still a lot of disease that's circulating in the community. And so we're hoping to capture some of that information so that we can get a better sense of everything that's happening in the community, which, of course, can contribute to flu viruses and other and their transmission patterns.
Are there any tools or computer programs or stuff that you would like to have better or that we don't have now?
Well, that's what we're always working on. We're always trying to develop new models. We're always trying to develop new statistical algorithms to bring the data to bear on the models. It's something that we're always dealing with. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it's a very challenging problem because the flu is always changing. That's the big reason why we have mistakes with it and why it's difficult to predict what's going on. It's always mutating. There's something called antigenic drift going on where the strain is constantly moving in its genetic space. And as a consequence, it evades people's immune systems, even if they've been previously infected by something similar.
Let me see if I get a quick call in from John in Washington, D.C. Go ahead, John.
Hi. I'm taking issue with the idea that knowing, having 100% prediction, would actually benefit anyone. I would like to know how that data would actually be used and how the government would be capable of actually affecting any change in the population.
Yeah, so you know the flu is going to happen. How does that benefit anybody?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things that we can imagine. From a public health perspective, we have a large country. If you know in a forecast that it's more likely it's going to peak in Seattle than in Atlanta, you can distribute vaccines and antivirals. Every year, hospitals have to deal with surge due to influenza, and sometimes this overwhelms certain hospital systems just for simple things like getting gloves and syringes, but also for ventilators and beds. And just about every year, there's a hospital somewhere where the nurses all go down with flu at the same time. And if they could manage that personnel capacity, that would be very beneficial. Now, we're not predicting anything with 100% certainty. These are our probabilistic forecasts. We don't have a crystal ball that can say this will happen. But, you know, we have analogies for that in all aspects of our life, including, again, weather. They don't tell you it's going to rain tomorrow. They tell you there's a 90% chance it's going to rain tomorrow.
Think we might see it on the forecast every night on the news?
That's what I would love. That's one of the things I always say. You already get pollen count. You already get pollution level. Why not have a local pathogen forecast?
Wow. I'm waiting for that one. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Rumi Chinnara is an assistant professor at the College of Global Public Health and the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at New York University. And Jeffrey Shaman is associate professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Wishing you a healthy winter coming up. Flu 3. We're going to take a break when we come back. It's our annual do-it-yourself Halloween bazaar. Give us a call with your Halloween hacks. 844-PSY-TALK. We have our own hacks to give you the best Halloween on your block or your apartment building. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Support for the Science Friday podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Every cancer, like every patient, is different. Advanced genomic testing can help our doctors understand each patient's cancer at the molecular level and may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more about the promise of precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Hear that sound? That spooky bubbling up from below? No, it's not a boiling witch's cauldron. It's an impromptu fog machine we rigged up in the sci-fi kitchen yesterday with just a little hot water and a bag of dry ice. And as All Hallows Eve tiptoes up behind us, it's time to break out your geeky do-it-yourself tricks. Why not frighten the neighbors with science? Call us with your Halloween hacks, 841-PSY-TALK, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us also at SciFry. Send us your photos. Maybe you've got some nice Halloween. Yeah, nice Halloween photos. You can tweet them at SciFry. Our guide to this phantom underworld of creepy crafty is Eric Wilhelm, founder of Instructables. He joins us from KQED. Welcome back, Eric. Nice to have you and Instructables back on Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
And we have featured some of your handpicked projects at sciencefriday.com/DIY Halloween. You got your costume ready, Eric?
I do.
Yeah?
I'm going to be Mad Max, and I have my 3-year-old son is going to be a war boy. We're going to be chained together and running around getting candy.
Wow. Wait, go ahead.
He's got that translucent little kid hair, so he almost looks bald, and a little bit of chalk, a little bit of makeup around the eyes. He's going to look awesome.
Well, right out of the Addams Family, sort of.
Exactly.
You know, one of the classic food items at Halloween parties is peeled grape eyeballs. and which don't look anything like eyeballs. But you,
those only work when you when you're in the dark. You have people put your hand in there and grab an eyeball. But if you want to serve an eye that looks like an eye, we've got a great project which is called Creepy Coconut Kiwi Panna Cotta, and it really looks like an eye. So the white of the eye is made from a coconut gelatin, and then you cut a kiwi to make up the striations of the iris, put a plumped raisin in the center, and then on top, to really make it look like an eye, you put clear gelatin to make the lens, and the thing looks like an eye. And then you sit it in some raspberry to make it look like it's pulled out, plopped on a plate, and still bleeding.
Wow. Looks like it popped right out of a Cyclops, right? Wow. I just got my first Arduino kit. I'm going to probably do a Periscope with it for everybody to watch me fool around with Arduinos. What kind of projects can you do with an Arduino? And that's a little chip. It's a computer chip, right, that you program?
Yeah, it's a little computer, and it's quite easy to set it up and make it interface with the real world. So two fun projects. One, using some light sensors and a servo, you can make a skeleton appear to follow you. So the way you do this is you have two light sensors and you arrange them so that they will register when someone walks by, when their shadow comes. So you can set up the lights such that depending on where the person's standing, their shadow is either going to be on the left or the right sensor. And then you can hook the skeleton head up to a servo so it can then point at where the person is standing. And so that way, as they walk by, that skeleton head will appear to follow them and watch them as they walk by.
That is spooky. How hard is it to make something and to program the Arduino?
So the fun thing about these is that you can find code available on the internet so that you can learn how it works. You can tweak a little bit and make it work for you. So it's actually quite easy. The Arduino itself plugs in your computer. You can upload the code you find, make a few changes, and then you can get it running. Mm.
Our listeners are already chiming in with their suggestions and maybe even improvements for stuff that we're talking about. Let's go to Bill in Oakland, California. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I found that the more hot the water, the more fog I get from dry ice. So now I'm using a coffee maker or Sterno to keep the water warm. And then I trained some kids to safely handle the dry ice. Hmm. And then I have to work less and less hard to have more and more fog.
Great. Thank you, Bill. For what do you say, Eric? A good tip?
Yeah. One of the tricks on dry ice is if you drop dry ice into some warm water, eventually you get water ice forming around the dry ice, which is frozen carbon dioxide. And that actually makes an insulating layer and prevents the carbon dioxide from subliming and bubbling up. So if you keep the water warm and you keep it agitated, you can actually prevent that layer of water ice from forming and get more fog out of it, exactly as described.
Great suggestion. Eric, you do, of course, have a few projects for our listeners who like to play with fire. And I'm thinking of a green flame for me.
This is a good one. So this is we call it the ghastly green fire. And what it is it's methanol and boric acid. So methanol is typically used as a gas line antifreeze and water remover. And then boric acid is an antiseptic or pesticide. And you can also find it in borax as a laundry detergent. And you mix the two together. And what you're aiming to do is you're aiming to make some trimethyl borate, which when it burns, it has a very distinctive green flame. And that green comes from the boron element. Mm-hmm. Now, this is... If you're making this in the couple of tablespoons range, it's about as safe as using lighter fluid on some charcoal. Mm-hmm. And the green it's a great green. It almost looks like the flue powder from the Harry Potter movies.
That methanol is a little bit dangerous. You got to be careful with how you deal with methanol. Our number, 844-724-8255. If you have a suggestion or you have an improvement or you'd like to ask a question, you're talking with Eric Wilhelm, who is founder of Instructables. And we're talking about the best Halloween do-it-yourself stuff. Let's talk about Rubin's Tube. Not Rubin's Cube, Rubik's Cube. Rubin's Tube. What is that?
So a Rubin's Tube, and this was developed by Heinrich Rubens, and it's a way to visualize the flow and pressure of sound waves. It's a flame tube. So it is a tube with a bunch of small holes that you flow a flammable gas down it and then put a speaker on the end and play a tone in that speaker, and the flames will be higher or lower based on the compressions or the rarefactions of the sound wave. So it's kind of like a primitive oscilloscope. It's a way of visualizing what a sound wave actually looks like.
So the flames sort of dancing then?
The flames can dance. If you run music through it, the flames are literally dancing.
Wow. Wow. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Rotham in Pittsburgh. Hi, Rotham.
Hi, it's Rotem.
So I'm sorry.
my little hack is I found a stuffed spider. It's about 3 feet wide at one of the toy shops. And what I did is actually ran fishing wire from inside my door out under my awning so that it hangs under the awning all the way up against it. And I have it hooked up to a little Lego Mindstorms kit that I've hooked up to with Bluetooth to my cell phone. And you can do it manually if you're not as technical. Just raise the push out more fishing wire, and it lets the spider drop down from the front, which is great for when you have trick-or-treaters. They come to the door, they ring the doorbell. While they're talking to you, while you give them candy, you lower it to about head height behind them, and when they turn around, there's a giant stuffed spider hanging at eye level right behind them.
And a loud scream coming.
Yeah, usually. I've only had one group of girls scream and run away from the house so far. Hopefully I'll get more next year.
You really went high-tech. You triggered from your cell phone?
Yeah, so one of the things that I had is I also set up a full Plinko board next to my house for the kids to toss ping pong balls into to see what kind of candy they get, because they can get full-size candy bars or the smaller ones. So some of them were playing that, and some of them were going to the door for my wife. And this way I can trigger it from my pocket while they're talking to my wife.
You know, say, take a picture and send it to us. Send it to us at SciFry, so we all can look at it on Twitter.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks a lot. Or Instagram it to us. Thanks a lot. Happy Halloween. There's some people, Eric, who really go nutty with the details, and that's the good part, right?
Halloween's my favorite holiday because it's the last holiday where DIY is best. A homemade project is always better than a store-bought costume, and everyone appreciates it when you make your own Halloween stuff.
Mm-hmm. One of your other food hacks is making candy glass shards. This isn't dangerous, is it?
So this is a cupcake, and it looks like it's covered in glass shards. And those glass shards are actually sugar glass. And you can make sugar glass by heating sugar and a little bit of corn syrup up to 300 Fahrenheit, and that gets it to the hard crack phase of candy making. You then put it in a baking pan, let it cool, and you get what amounts to a clear, hard candy that's in the shape of glass. And you can break it apart. It's brittle, actually, similar to glass. And you can put those shards into the cupcake, and you can bite it, and it really looks like you're eating broken glass. And, of course, put some more red food coloring, some more red syrup on it, and it looks like your cupcake is glass and covered in blood.
It's probably what they're doing in the movies anyhow, right?
Sugar glass is often used in movies.
Yeah. 844-724-8255 is a number. Also, you can reach us at SciFry. 844-724-8255. Let's go to Walnut Creek, California, to Sean. Hi, Sean. Welcome.
Hi, Ira. How you doing?
Hi there.
Good. Well, I wanted to share the work project with my sons and I are doing this year, which is an Arduino-based pumpkin stage. We've got some carved plastic jack-o'-lanterns that are being driven by an Arduino, listening to the music, and changing their light structure based off of the music so they look like they're singing.
Singing pumpkins, flashing.
Indeed.
Now, if you could only get those carved mouths moving up and down.
For next year, but we're on it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Eric, reaction to that?
I love that kind of stuff. I love it when stuff's dancing. And you can also make the Arduino make skeletons look like they're speaking. So you can hook up a sound shield to get play some pre-recorded sayings or screams or laughs, and then sync it in time to a servo moving the mouth of a skeleton, and you can make a skeleton talk.
Wow. Let me bring up another topic called pumpkin Tetris. Need I say more?
So in the pumpkin Tetris, which is lovingly called pumptress, you carefully carve out what amounts to a screen in your pumpkin and then put LEDs behind it so you can then play Tetris on your pumpkin. So you've got a lo-fi, low resolution screen that's carved into your pumpkin, and you play Tetris right on your pumpkin's face.
Wow. And you know, for theater aficionados, you have instructions on how to build an illusion, which I have seen for many, many years at Disneyland, Disney World, and the Haunted House. You see the haunted people, you know, the ghosts in there. I never figured out how they did that because it was before computer graphics, right? And they had to do it a different way. And you explain it. Pepper's Ghost.
So this is Pepper's Ghost. So it's named after scientist John Henry Pepper, who popularized it in about 1860. And the way it works is you have a clear material, glass or plexiglass, and you can see through the glass, but you can also see reflections on the glass. So the glass is oriented at about 45 degrees to the viewers, and so they're both looking through it and they're seeing a reflection. So off to the side, you have another scene. So it's either a projector or it could just be a scene that's properly lit, that's masked from the way the viewers are looking at the glass. But as you turn the lights up on that side scene, right, you can suddenly see the reflection. And so what happens is, to the viewers, they see both what's through the glass but also what's being reflected on the glass. And you can make it appear that ghosts will ghoulishly appear, disappear. People will change. This is an old carnival trick from the girl turning into a gorilla, where you have a woman sitting and then an image of a gorilla, and you change the lighting such that she appears to change into a gorilla.
We're talking about creepy crawly things you can make for Halloween on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Eric Wilhelm, founder of Instructables. That's all kinds of folks with great ideas. Let's go right to them. Let's go to Kansas City, Missouri with Joe. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Ira. How's it going?
Hey there.
Hey there. Okay, so my Halloween idea is you take empty toilet paper tubes and you cut like eyes in them, sort of like jack-o'-lantern eyes or something like that, kind of creepy little eyes. And then you can take button cell batteries and LED lights, and you sort of tape the leads from the LED light around the battery, and you can place them around the yard. It's like creepy glowing eyes sitting around the yard.
Whoa, that's an easy thing to do.
Yeah, it's very easy.
And so you can even light the path to the doorway.
You definitely can, and they last for quite a while, too, since LEDs don't use much battery.
All right. Thanks, Joe, for that hint. There's a lot of stuff, Eric, you can do with LEDs. That was a good little suggestion.
Yeah, that particular one, we lovingly call those LED throwies, and you can also do things like add a magnet to it so that you can stick them on stuff.
Mm-hmm. What is the watermelon brain?
So if you want to have a brain, so similar to the eyes, if you want to serve your guests' eyes and brain, what you can do is you can carefully scrape the skin off of a watermelon so that it goes from green to white, and then you can carve further down into the watermelon to expose the red flesh. And what you can get is you can get something that looks a lot like a brain. So it's got the white on the surface, but then red kind of canyons in it. And you carve it in the pattern of the folds of a brain, and you can serve a giant watermelon brain.
Something I was always trying to do. Never quite figured that out. Can you look into your Halloween crystal ball and try to tell us what fashions are going to be all the rage this year? You have any idea?
Well, given my costume, it's all going to be Mad Max.
So you think people, though, because you can take LEDs and these little flat batteries and put so much together, people might wear them now as costumes?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can take it even further. You can actually get some fiber optic cables and use those to sculpt light so that you could make things that look like fairy wings. We've got a great project called Programmable Fiber Optic Fairy Wings, where the wings are made from thin gauge metal, and then fiber optic fibers are traced around to form the veins of a wing, and then they're illuminated by LEDs. So you can program it to change colors, to turn on and off, but it looks like a glowing pair of wings.
Wow. So take some time. You got to allow yourself some time to work on these things. Don't wait before the day before Halloween if you want to make some of these projects.
That's right. I mean, this is the weekend to start. You have 2 weekends ahead of to make your costume.
All right, we're going to take a break. We have lots more to talk about with Eric Wilhelm, founder of Instructables. If you'd like to give us a call with some suggestions, lots of good ones coming in, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. You can send us some of your photos there on that tweet. Also, you know, we got Tumblr and other kinds of places, Instagram. Send us all kinds of stuff. We'll share it with everybody out there. Maybe you've got some great ideas people would like to have. We're going to take a break. As I say, we'll be right back after this short break. Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, presenting The Message. How we missed it, no one knows, but now Nikki Tomlin, a PhD in linguistics from the University of Chicago, is working on deciphering it. With her team of cryptologists at a research think tank called Cypher, Tomlin is trying to decode a message received from outer space 70 years ago, or so they think. This new 8-episode sci-fi podcast series blurs the line between reality and fiction, as the famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast did almost 80 years ago. Are we 70 years too late on deciphering the message? Why did the aliens reach out to us? Don't miss any of the details. Subscribe to this podcast from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply called The Message on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Again, that's The Message from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about how to do it yourself this Halloween. Why not build that Arduino-powered motion-detecting skull? Boy, that sounds like a good one. Build that this year. And you know, when you do that, send us. Take a picture of it and send it to us at, you know, Science Friday, at SciFry. You can also Instagram it to us. And also, we do want to hear about your DIY projects so we can share a few as we count down to Halloween. Use your smartphone and record a voice memo, and then email it to us at mystory@sciencefriday.com. That's mystory@sciencefriday.com. Tell us your name, where you're from, and what you made and how you did it. And try to keep it under a minute or two, and we'll collect all of them, and everybody can share each other's stories. Story of this hour is my guest, Eric Wilhelm, founder of Instructables, about stuff we can do in Halloween. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Barbara in Washington. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. We thought, of course, we were very clever when we were kids, but this actually was kind of clever. You take a safety pin and open it, not quite the whole way, but open it like a quarter of the way. Put a little string through the hole up where the hooky part of the safety pin is. You would have to get up to the house and stick the pin of the safety pin in the glazing around the window. And you'd have a very long string, so then you'd go back out to the sidewalk. And you'd just pull the string, and it would go tap, 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 tap on the window. And you could watch the people just sort of looking around. And then if they decided to come to the door to see what was going on, you just pull the string and keep going and do it to another house. And the scary part was you had to get close to the house. But yeah, it worked. We loved it.
Scared and, people at their own homes, huh? You sort of did a reverse. Yeah, it's a reverse scaring thing.
Right. Just make people crazy. And then the other great thing, of course, was a nice handful of unpopped popcorn. Just throw it at the window, and that's pretty scary, too. But we had fun. We enjoyed it. It was pretty easy.
Low-tech versions.
Exactly.
Some old-fashioned low-tech ways.
I hope somebody does it this year.
All right, Barbara, thanks for calling. Yeah, Eric, sometimes you can be low-tech like that.
I've got a big smile on my face over the safety pin. That's awesome.
What other things are you thinking about maybe for coming years? Do you work on stuff that may take more than 1 year to come to fruition?
One of the things I used to do when I lived in Somerville in Boston was a haunted porch. And so I would collect things over many years to put as part of the haunted porch. And one of the ones that I remember fondly was I postered the neighborhood with signs that said blood bank open sunset to sunrise, please come give donations. And I had a peristaltic pump that pumped a bunch of V8 juice around and had an actual bowl flowing. And my favorite part of this was you'd get kids that would come up and they're in the 4 to 7 range and they'd say, that's not real blood. And you look them in the eye and you'd say, but it's salty. And they'd, they'd have to think about that and they'd have to think, would an adult really lie to me? It might actually be blood. And then they'd back away carefully.
Oh, goodness. Right. Spinning things out. Let's go to the phone. Kathy in Ormond, Florida. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
Hey there.
I have a question for you. For Halloween, our theater opens its doors to younger children, and we recreate magical moments from various fairy tales. So one of them is for Cinderella, when Cinderella's fairy godmother changes her from her cinders outfit into her ball gown. My dilemma is I have not been able to figure out how to create like a big puff of smoke or a big flash of light to happen when Cinderella does this quick change, so to speak. Since I've got kids and costumes, I'm very worried about using those, like a smoke bomb or anything.
Yeah. Eric, do you have a suggestion for her?
I think something called flash paper is actually intended for this purpose. So it's typically used in theatrical settings, and I think it's relatively safe, so it's not going to set the whole costume on fire, but you'd want to check in with someone who really knows what they're doing. But I think you'll find something productive if you search for flash paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric, we've run out of time. I want to wish you a lot of success with your Mad Max motif this year.
Thank you very much.
And has your three-year-old bought into this yet, or is this a surprise for him?
Oh, he's ready. No, he's totally ready. He's ready for the silver spray paint. And he says all the time, I live, I die, I live again.
I can't top that. Thank you, Eric. Eric Wilhelm, founder of Instructables. And as I say, we want to hear about your project so we can share a few as we count down to Halloween. Just take your smartphone, record a voice memo, then email it to us at mystory@sciencefriday.com, mystory@sciencefriday.com. Tell us your name, where you're from, what you made, how you did it, and try to keep it under a minute or two. Our phones, right? You use them for just about anything. You can control your home thermostat from work, watch movies on demand. You can wire money through the mail. But trying to hear the person on the other end is getting harder and harder to do. It's not so easy. Cell phone plans can cost hundreds of dollars these days. So why are we spending so much for dropped calls and muddled conversations? Do you notice that? I noticed this on my own cell phone. The cell phone is deteriorating. The call is. Why do we send packets of data, but not we can't send a simple phone call? What's holding us back? Jeff Hecht is a freelance science and technology writer based out of Boston. Welcome to Science Friday, Jeff.
Thank you, Ira.
You wrote a very good article recently in the IEEE Journal on this very problem. Landline phones still sound pretty good. What's the difference between the landline phone and a mobile phone?
Well, there's a number of differences, and the primary one is the whole connection to the network. You sit, when you're talking on a landline phone, you're usually sitting in a room at which where you can be quiet. If you're on a mobile phone, you're in outside, wandering around. The phone itself is different. If you look at an old wired handset, it has cups on both ends. One lets you talk into it. One lets you is coupled over your ear, so you hear that better. It doesn't get as much noise in it. If you look at a smartphone, it's a slab of glass. You have no tactile sense of how you're holding the microphone part close to your mouth, which you need to get a good voice in. That microphone is very sensitive, so it also picks up noise in the area. So that's another problem. If there's noise around you or you're outside, or if you're talking in a car with the window down, it can sound like you're driving through a hurricane in a convertible. In that wind.
Yeah.
And then you have the connection of how do you get the connection to the cell phone tower. You look at that and your phone, and it'll give you 1 to 5 bars. So if you see one bar, then it's pretty feeble connection. And the other problem there is that you're sharing the connection to the cell phone with a number of other people in that same area. So all that adds up to less bandwidth for you. And when the less bandwidth between you and the cell tower, the more your voice has to be compressed.
Mm-hmm. Is there any truth to the idea that, you know, fewer and fewer people? No, I don't know any teenager that makes a phone call anymore, right? So we're all texting, we're all sending photos, we're doing those things that are not voice related. So the cell phone company is saying, why should we spend our time making a good cell phone that sounds good when no one's using the sound?
Well, I think it's more a case of neglect than anything. In fact, when I started working on that article a couple of years ago, I could not get any of the major cell phones companies to return calls. They started returning calls once they started having some technology that there's a technology called HD voice that is developing that will give you better quality calls if you're using a 4G phone that comes with some special equipment called Volte. And what that does is it essentially digitizes your phone call right away, puts it into the data stream so that it goes with all the streaming video or whatever you're watching or listening to at the time. Mm-hmm. Those bits will get special priority because they're voice and they have to be transited fast or people get restless.
Yeah.
Your ear is very sensitive to the timing of voice.
Yeah, and if you're on a landline, and is there any such thing as a strict landline anymore, or is every phone call, whether it comes from New York or it comes from, you know, out in the middle of a farm in the Midwest in a rural place, are any phone calls purely on a landline in the old way that it was sent, or is everything digitized now?
Everything is not digitized all the way back to the phone. A lot of them are. If you're in a metropolitan area, you have, you know, I have Verizon Fios, for example. The AT&T, Comcast have similar services where they're digitizing your voice and simulating a landline so that it seems just like a landline. It has the same frequency bandwidth, and it doesn't get compressed as you do when you have a weak connection to the cell tower.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm making a call from a landline to a landline, let's just say in a rural area, that's staying analog in the old-fashioned way, you know, with the wire all the way from phone to phone?
That's probably only if you're in the same town. Mm. Any place else, it will be digitized at a telephone switching office, and there's a very rigid bandwidth format for that actually pretty much reproduces the bandwidth of a landline phone, and that can be transmitted over longer distances. So, you know, this is, but what's happening now is that the FCC and the telephone carriers are talking about phasing out these old landlines because the technology is obsolete, and they're going to have to can't maintain it, or they're claiming they can't maintain it, I should say.
Yeah. Well, it's much cheaper, you know. The old copper. Copper is expensive, and copper landlines are going to cost a lot to maintain. I'm talking with Jeff Hecht, who's a science and technology writer in Boston. We're talking about the cell phone quality. Our number, 844-724-8255, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And let's do an on-air test right here. Maria from Alameda, California, is on a landline.
Hi there. Hey, I had more of a comment than a question. I thought I'd use my old red phone. It's got the dials that go in a circle.
No kidding.
And I thought I'd see what it would sound like if I called it.
Can you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Can you twist, turn zero for us?
Yep, you got it.
There is a whole generation of people who have never heard that sound.
Yeah, I love this phone. You know, my partner and I were talking about how he got really excited that he could get an 8-foot charging cord for his cell phone so he could talk on the cell phone and still be charging it. And I thought, why is that different than the old landlines we used to have?
Wow.
Anyway.
Give me a zero one more time on the way out here.
You got it.
Thank you, Maria, for that. You made my day on that one. Thanks. Yeah, that is a vanished sound. Maybe that sound, we should send that over to the Smithsonian or something, Jeff, you know. Yeah, I'm surprised they still exist. They still exist, those digital, the analog with the dial-up?
I have one in my foyer. It doesn't. I don't call out on it, but I can get calls in on it. It's it must be 30 years old.
Well, tell us why HD voice is taking so long to roll out.
Well, one of the big problem is it's not. You have to phase in a whole new technology, and right now landlines have a bandwidth of roughly up to 3,500 hertz. HD voice offers twice that bandwidth, up to 7 kilohertz. And that's important in understanding certain sounds. I mean, for example, my favorite example is you can't tell Jeff from Jess on a landline because the extra sound that is extra high frequencies just get caught off. I verified that on a conference call one time with a Jess, and I started every time. They tried to say, Jess, something? And I piped up, I'm here.
Because people don't realize that you're actually sharing that line with a lot of other people, aren't you? And then you're not hearing your brain. They're taking out part of the conversation that your mind puts back in.
Well, yeah, that's the whole frequency. Old Bell system, probably back in the 1930s, decided that was good enough for a conversation.
Yeah.
Up to that bandwidth limit. And they needed to pack as many calls in as they could over wires in between the central offices in the long distance.
Yeah.
So they just squeezed that down as tight as they could.
All right, let me see if I can get a quick call in from Ron in West Bloomfield, Michigan. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Enjoying the program. I was in on the original Nextel push-to-talk two-way system, and originally it had a 6-to-1 compression ratio, which was great for push-to-talk. But when they tried it on the phones, they took out all of the harmonics, and you couldn't understand and identify the person you were talking to. So they switched it back to 3-to-1.
All right. And that's what we're talking about, that compression. You don't have a cell phone, Jeff, do you?
I don't have a smartphone. I do have a dumb phone, but
and it works better than a smartphone, you think?
It's cheaper. Dumb phone does have one advantage. It's a flip phone, so there's a logical place to hold it to my mouth, where my one side's on my ear, one side's on my mouth. I can feel where it is, so it doesn't just drift off. Because sometimes if you drift off a little bit, then people don't know where you're talking anymore.
What a revolutionary idea that is. Back to the future. Jeff Hecht is a science and technology writer based out of Boston. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Thank you, Ira.
And just to let everybody know, earlier this week we tested 3 different phones in Times Square to compare the audio quality, and you can listen to that test on our website at sciencewriter.com/phone-test. See what different phones sound like. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And calling all fans of Minnesota, we're visiting the Twin Cities in just a few weeks with a live stage show at the Fitzgerald Theater. Tuesday, November 3rd, we're going to investigate how animals regrow their limbs. We are. And whether we could someday do the same at a quiz show where science meets your comic book heroes, and it's a Science of Superpowers. That's November 3rd at the Fitz. Tickets are going fast, so find out more. sciencefriday.com/Minnesota. It's come out in the evening. We're going to be doing it in the evening, so you'll have time to